name is Edmund White, and we're in my apartment in New York City. And I'm a writer, and I've written maybe 25 books. And most recently, I finished a novel that will come out next year called Jack Holmes and His Friend, which is about a straight man and a gay man who are best friends in New York in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And now I'm writing a memoir about life in Paris in the 1980s, where I lived.
Where and when were you born, Edmund?
I was born in Ohio in January 1940.
And how was Ohio as a young man, as a teen?
Well, we left when I was seven, so...
Where did you move to?
We moved all over the Midwest and Texas. My parents were both Texans. So we went to Dallas, but my mother was very restless, and she would move every year, Rockford, Illinois. Anyway, I was all over Illinois, Ohio, and Michigan, because I went away to boarding school when I was 14 in Michigan. Then I went to the University of Michigan.
So Michigan is where you grew up or came out as a gay man?
No, because I came out very young, at 12, so even before going to the boarding school in Michigan.
And how was this experience of coming out at such an early age? I mean, what kind of world did you encounter when you were coming out?
Well, it's very bizarre. I think my experiences were fairly bizarre, certainly atypical. Some of my first gay experiences were with hustlers in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I had a little summer job for my father, and I would go and hire men who were much older than myself to have sex with me, and then I'd have to rent a hotel room. And I was maybe 14, 15, and they were maybe 25. But I did that all the time, and I did it because I couldn't figure out any other way to have gay sex. I also had sex with the neighbor boy, but he was quite reluctant. And then I had sex at camp with other boys at camp, summer camp. And then eventually, when I went to boarding school, I had sex with boys at the boarding school. Then I had sex, even at a very early age, like 13, 14, with people I met in public toilet. Mostly married men, mostly terrified of me. One of the problems about our laws about young people is that it's very hard for the young people to ever see anybody more than once because you're jail bait. So nobody wants to see you, give you their phone number, nothing, you know. So there's no continuity in the sex life of a teenager.
So it seems like you were a really precocious sexual person.
I was precocious in every way. I was very intelligent, and I wrote a novel by the time I was 14, and I was a singer, I was the head of the glee club, I got straight A's, I was, you know, but not athletically. I wasn't athletic, but I was a dancer. I danced a lot in high school productions.
And despite encountering gay life in a kind of matter-of-fact way, in the sense that you were engaging in sexual practices, how were you thinking of homosexuality and how was it presented at the time? How did you fit into the paradigm at the moment, if you will?
I thought of it as a very bad thing. A very bad thing that was slightly glamorous. But I knew it was a very bad thing, and so I wanted to go to a psychiatrist to be cured. So by age 16, I was going to a psychiatrist who three times a week, I had to tell my parents I was gay in order to get them to pay for the psychiatrist. My feeling was I wanted to be a writer. I always knew I wanted to be a writer. And I thought that if you were homosexual and a writer, you would be so limited that nobody would want to read your books, which is sort of true.
And what was your experience of homosexual writers at the time? Did you have access to anything, or were you looking for this kind of content in the books that you were reading?
Well, I mean, there was Thomas Mann's Death in Venice. There were André Gide's journals. Eventually, in the 60s, there were other things like Isherwood's A Single Man. There were lots of cheap books sold under the counter, pornographic books, not with pictures, but with text.
For example, in Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, how did you relate to this death, this gay character that in a way is so overdetermined by drama and death?
Well, I think almost all the fiction of that period was like that. That's why I say it was very, homosexuality was very bad, but also very glamorous, because it did involve rich people, doomed people, death. I mean, there were novels about, there was one called Quatrefoil, there was another one called Finisterre, and they were about beautiful young men who met each other and went and lived in some remote place, like on a cliff overlooking the ocean, and then they committed suicide. So I think it definitely felt like a very doomed, bad thing.
When did you start to think about writing about gay issues? When does it become something a priority
right away.
For you? Right away.
Right. At age 14, I wrote a novel called The Tower Window, and it was all about a boy who is in love with a girl, but he's also fascinated by a Mexican man whom he has sex with. And then when the girl rejects him, he flings himself at the Mexican man. And I had never read such a novel at that point. I mean, I invented this genre because it wasn't pornographic. It was very serious. It was tragic. But really nothing I had read was about contemporary American life with gay content.
What about in other countries? Were you following the path of some other writers that you may have, no?
Those books, you know, if you were a Midwestern schoolboy, your chances of hearing... I mean, the odd thing was that there were books that that had a kind of appeal to a gay person. I can't tell you why. That weren't gay. I mean, I'm thinking of Hermann Hesse's books, especially Steppenwolf. But I think Steppenwolf is so much about an alienated person who always contemplates suicide and feels a great, I keep thinking in French, soulagement. He feels such a great comfort that he can always commit suicide and escape from this terrible world. Well, that was something I think that many gay people could have identified with, and did. He was a very popular writer with gay people, but there's nothing gay in it.
Across the board, the representation of gayness at the time was as something tragic, as a kind of doomed experience, or was there in any possible way, perhaps not in literature, but perhaps in the movies or elsewhere, a positive representation of a homosexual life?
Well, I lived in a boarding school. We saw only the movies that they showed us.
Right.
Every Saturday night, we went into a gymnasium and saw a movie. So, and before that, my own parents didn't approve of movies, so I never was allowed to see movies. So my experience of movies was very limited. There were no Netflix, no television. So your chance of encountering anything other than standard Hollywood comedies. Now, mind you, in some of those comedies, there was a little hint of homosexuality. Bringing Up Baby, did you ever see this one?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a Gary Cooper movie, and in it he wears a dress and he uses camp language and stuff. So there were movies like this, but you had to have first of all, you had to see them. And I would never have been shown a movie like that.
When you wrote this first novel of yours, was it published?
No.
It something? It wasn't.
No, I didn't even really try to get it. I never tried to get it published.
So were you thinking of the experience of writing as something that you were doing for yourself, or were you already thinking of constructing an audience and readership?
Oh, I never did it for myself. I've never understood writers who say they write for themselves. To me, the only way I can write is imagining the impact that what I'm writing will have on a reader. I mean, there's a kind of criticism called reader-oriented criticism, and that's, I've never read it, but anything about it, but that makes sense to me, that you would want to know how you influence the reader. And when I teach creative writing, and what I like about teaching a group of people who have all read the same stories by each other is that you get a lot of reader response.
What is the next book you write, or the next book that you actually publish and has a readership that establishes you as a writer?
My first novel was called Forgetting Elena, and it was well received. Even Nabokov said it was his favorite American novel. So that was good, but
it's a good compliment.
Yeah, but it was a small. It didn't sell very many copies or anything. And then my next book, Nocturnes for the King of Naples, was my first gay book, gay book. I mean, obviously gay book, and it had a small gay following. But the book that I guess The Joy of Gay Sex was a book that had a huge readership. States of Desire, Travels in Gay America, was a book that received a lot of press attention. But the one that really made my name was A Boy's Own Story.
But before we get into some of the books, because I have specific questions about some of them, I would like to ask you, when you moved to New York, I mean, did you, after you finished graduate school, college, you came to New York?
I didn't go to graduate school. I only went 4 years to.
And when was that? What date is it?
1962.
And how was New York at the time in terms of gay sexuality?
Very exciting. Very exciting. It was very different from now, because now everything is ruled by the internet and there aren't very many face-to-face encounters. Whereas then, everything was done on the street, because there were virtually no gay bars, because the mayor had closed down all the bars to clean up the city for the World's Fair. So, which meant that you'd walk down Greenwich Avenue or Christopher Street at any hour, and there were tons of gay men cruising each other. You had to be good at that, but there were no bars, and there was no internet, so there were no back rooms, there was no nothing. Everything was done on the street in front of everybody. But there were thousands of people. And it was very exciting. And the very first night I was here, which was July 19th, 1962, a friend of mine took me to a gay restaurant. And the idea of a gay restaurant seemed so remarkable to me, because I knew that gays would go to certain places in order to have sex or to meet each other to have sex. But the idea that they might enjoy socializing with each other, because I saw them as a ras maudite, I couldn't imagine that this cursed people would ever want to socialize together.
So you never envisioned it as a kind of community or communities
of
sorts?
Not at all. And I had no community feeling. And if I had been in a building having sex with other men, and then as I walked out the building caught on fire, I wouldn't have even turned back to say fire. I mean, to me, these people were not friends or anybody I liked or anything, There was so much self-hatred. I was still going to psychiatrists.
I would like you to elaborate a bit more on that, because what that suggests to me is that you thought of being a homosexual as exclusively a sexual act.
Yes.
It didn't have anything to do with kinship or partnership or friendship or any of this.
Actually, I had a lover, and that's why I came to New York. Because for a second time I'd been accepted to Harvard, a second time I didn't go, because this boy I was in love with came here. And then he and I lived together almost immediately as a couple, and we stayed together for 7 years. But we did not know any other people like ourselves. In other words, at work where we work, we both work for Time Magazine. You could never ever say that you were gay or that you had a lover, or even see this lover very often. You wouldn't dare go by his desk too often.
And what about cruising on the street? Was that also an act of a secret act?
It depended on the place. If you were Saturday night at midnight on Greenwich Avenue and Christopher Street, there'd be swarms of people all cruising each other, and it was okay to do. There was always the possibility you might pick up an undercover policeman who would arrest you.
Was that common?
Not too common. I mean, it had been common where I had lived in Michigan. At the University of Michigan, one of my best friends was entrapped by a plainclothes policeman and had to spend the next 7 years seeing a psychiatrist once a week for 7 years. He was on parole for 7 years for just touching somebody's penis in a toilet.
Do you remember when homosexuality was decriminalized in the United States? Was it 1972?
It was never decriminalized in the whole United States. It was only state by state.
Okay.
And, I mean, as far as I know, there might still be some states where it is illegal. But when I started out, it was a capital punishment in Georgia. You could cut somebody's head off for being gay.
Were there specific sites at the time in which this gay cruising was happening? Was it the Greenwich Village already?
It was Greenwich Village.
What about Times Square? Was that more a site of hustling?
Hustling, yes. I mean, Times Square, you would go to... Well, there were shops that sold pornography, but they were always being raided and closed. Everything was always being raided. And as I say, the bars, if you... For instance, maybe around 1966 or 7, some gay bars began to open. The one that always survived was Julius's, and it never closed. But it had very weird and strict rules, depending on the year. But for instance, at one point, you could not stand at the bar facing the bar. You had to stand at the bar looking out toward the windows. And because I think they were afraid the police would walk by, see all these men touching shoulders, and think that they were maybe touching each other. So you had to, you know, even on Fire Island, you could not dance with another man, or even with four other men. In every group of men dancing, there had to be at least one woman. And a guard sat on a very high ladder with a
flashlight?
Flashlight, probably. I want to say. and would point it at people where he suspected there was no woman in the group.
And during the 60s, did you have relationships with lesbian women? Was there already a kind of community identification, or was it a different story for women at the time?
I knew one of my closest friends, that's her picture up there, was a lesbian, and I had actually been engaged to her briefly, and we're still best friends, 60 years later. And she came to New York at more or less at the same time I came. So through her, I met other lesbians. But I don't think I would have met them otherwise. I mean, I knew her I met her first when I was 15 years old. And I didn't know she was a lesbian. And then gradually, we became close and engaged. And then I realized she was a lesbian, and I realized I was gay, and we went our separate ways. But she lived with me for a while. So, in other words, this was not unheard of, but I don't think gay men would never have gone to lesbian bars, although I did go with her sometimes to the Duchess and to... There were several lesbian bars in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And I think they were not as badly treated by the police as the gay male bars.
Can you tell me your experience and memory of Stonewall? What happened then, and how did you relate to this event? Were you participating, or?
I had a friend called Charles Birch, who was a very fiery activist kind of person, and very leftist. I was rather conventional person. We were walking by the Stonewall at the very moment when it was raided. We weren't in it, but we were walking past. And we stayed to find out what was going on. And we witnessed the whole thing of the men being, the customers being dragged out of the bar and put in a black Mariah and taken away, while some police stayed behind to guard the remaining people, because there wasn't enough room in the paddy wagon for all of them. And then most of the people who were arrested were the staff members, not so much the clients, but there were clients arrested. And what was remarkable about the experience was that instead of running away, which had always been the case for gay people, and just trying to vanish, we rebelled. And I think it was for a number of reasons. Judy Garland had just died. It was an extremely hot summer day. The clients at the bar were mostly black and Puerto Rican. Though it was in Greenwich Village, these people were called A-trainers because they took the A-train down. And they were ghetto kids who were used to fighting with the police for other reasons. And all the bars had been closed for so long, and now they seemed to be reopening, and now suddenly they wanted to close this bar. So everybody was terrified that the police were going back to their bad ways.
So this kind of raid and police brutality was common, of course.
Oh, yeah.
It happened all the time.
All the time.
So it was Stonewall was just a point in which people just couldn't take it anymore.
That's right. But it was partly because there had been a kind of amnesty for maybe 2 years before that, where they weren't closing the bars or raiding them. Because we had a new mayor, John Lindsay, who was fairly liberal Republican. And I think he had left the gay community alone. But suddenly, I think the real reason they raided it was a mafia bar, of course. And I think they raided it because they suspected drug dealing. Mm-hmm. It was also very unsanitary. They had no source of running water behind the bar, so they just took the old glasses and wiped them out and served them. I mean, it was really a disgusting bar. But I think historical rebellions like that are always for the wrong reason. I mean, like when the Bastille was destroyed by the people, there were only four prisoners in it, and one of them was Saad, who obviously belonged there. So, you know, it's always some wrong reason, but why not?
How did Stonewall and the period after influence your writing?
Stonewall had a profound effect on me, and I would not have even been able to predict that a historical event like that could influence my inner feelings so much. But I was, I think I went rather quickly from thinking there is no gay community to there is a gay community, to gays are bad, to gays are good, to I'm ashamed of being gay, to I am proud of being gay, to I don't want to, well, I guess I always wanted to write about gay subject matter, but suddenly I was interested in addressing a gay reader. I think in the past, this was the difference. In the past, gay writers were apologizing for gay life to straight readers. Now, after Stonewall, but not right away, it took 10 years, gay writers were addressing other gay people, gay readers, and they were saying, oh, this is the way we live now. And so it was very different. It wasn't an apology. It was a communication from one gay person to another.
Did you and your peers at the time, I mean, really 6 months later, a year later, understood Stonewall as a historical event?
Yes.
It was so clear that it had been...
Yes. I mean, not 2 days later, but maybe 2 weeks later, it was already very clear, because there began to be a lot of articles about it, like in the Village Voice, in other leftist little magazines, like the East Village Other and the I, and there were lots of little magazines at the time, and people began to write articles about the significance of it.
And did you write anything in particular about this?
No. I wrote a famous letter. I mean, it became famous because I had two friends, a gay writer named Alfred Korn, who was at that time married to a woman called Anne Jones. And they were living, they were away for the summer. They were in the West Coast. And I wrote a long letter about what I had seen. Maybe I wrote it the next day or 2 days later. And that's one of the few documents that exists by an eyewitness.
At what point do you start to think of your writing, especially I'm thinking, for example, of the deeply personal books like your autobiographical novels, as having some kind of political content? Or did you think of them in those terms?
I think every gay writer, starting in the maybe 1972, 1973, 1974, was very aware of the possible political content of his work because of the almost Stalinist tenor of the gay literary community. I mean, there were a lot of gay critics suddenly, and they would take writers to task for being politically incorrect. They didn't use that word, but they would say that you were not showing a positive role model. There was this idiotic idea that you had to present gay characters in a positive light, which was completely ahistorical and in a way completely against any intelligent point you might be trying to make, because you wouldn't want to show a gay character as being liberated and happy and positive in a period when he was oppressed. Why would you bother to have a revolution?
Can you talk to me about The Joy of Gay Sex, this project? How does it come to be? Because it seems to be, as you said already, very much directed to a gay audience. I mean, it is about a gay audience, for a gay audience.
Oh, yeah.
How did this project come about?
Well, there was an English book packager called Mitchell Beasley. And Mitchell Beasley, there was two people, and they had packaged and then published The Joy of Sex, the original Joy of Sex by Alex Comfort. And it was a huge success all over the world. It sold millions of copies. And so they thought they would repeat their success, or at least a small part of it, by having a Joy of Lesbian Sex and a Joy of Gay Sex. And I had to audition for it. There were maybe 10 writers who had to submit samples. And then a psychiatrist also, because the idea was that you would be teamed with a doctor, and so it would be a writer and a doctor. Well, I won the competition.
Was it a gay doctor?
It was my own psychiatrist.
Oh, your own psychiatrist.
Who was gay. Okay. Because I forgot to say that even though I kept seeing psychiatrists, after Stonewall, I made the great leap forward of seeing a gay psychiatrist, because my idea now was that I would be gay. I didn't want to be straight, but I wanted to be happy gay. I wanted to sort out some of my personal problems. So anyway, and he quite ethically said, you can be my collaborator or you can be my patient, but you can't be both. So I was so broke and I needed money so badly that I stopped being his patient and became his collaborator. And that was a book that was very successful. People made fun of me for writing it. But basically, Americans love money. So anything that makes money, they end up by respecting.
Who was making fun of you? Your intellectual peers?
Yeah.
Because they thought it was a banal...
trashy book, yeah.
And what kind of impact did it have for you and your and the way that you thought of writing and gayness, for example?
The idea that there were lots of people out there who were uninstructed and that were suffering. 17-year-old boy living in a small town in Missouri, that these people you could actually reach and be reassuring. I found that an interesting idea. I like that idea. And then later, I think when I wrote States of Desire, it was sort of, I thought, well, maybe I'll travel around and actually meet some of these people. Because I traveled for a year before I wrote that book. And then later when I wrote A Boy's Own Story, I thought, well, I'll take one of those people myself and show an in-depth portrait of him, although it's fictional.
When you started writing Boy's Own Story, did you know that it would be a long-term project that would be sequeled by two?
No. No, I didn't. I thought it was a one-off. And then when it was a success, I thought, well, I could go on with this because there are other interesting things to say. I mean, Boy's Own Story is basically a fairly gloomy look at a teenager who's very conflicted and unhappy in the 1950s. Then I thought, well, I can write about that boy coming to New York and having a gay life, but still being very conflicted, and have the book end with Stonewall, which it does. And it's so it's actually a very strong political statement at the end of a novel, which was not popular among serious novelists in those days. You didn't quite think that was the right thing to do. But as I approached the end of the book, I kept debating with myself whether to put that in or not. And finally I did. I thought, it's the single biggest thing that's ever happened to me, so I might as well put it in.
Was this book strictly autobiographical and the other two as well, or there is an element of fiction in them?
There's quite a bit of fiction in them, mainly in what's left out. I mean, for instance, as I mentioned to you, I was very precocious sexually, but the boy in Boy's Own Story is not at all, because I was afraid that if I showed a freak like myself having sex with 200 people by the time he was 16, that people would say, well, this kid is not like me. He's completely sick and should go to a hospital. And
so you were concerned about the gay reader, not the straight reader judging?
Well, either one. I just thought nobody's going to be able to identify with this person, both straight or gay.
At this point, have you already established a certain kind of network amongst other gay writers, be it nationally or internationally? Is there a community that has started to be formed?
Well, I mean, I belong to a writers group called the Violet Quill, which was sort of a joke name. And there were eight of us, I think, and we met over a two-year period, and late 70s, early 80s. And we would read to each other. And it was very exciting to have a group of peers who would listen to chapters from your book. I was working on Boy's Own Story, in fact. Mm-hmm. And I think it was partly that people, the various writers, figured out what was their turf. You know, like there was a writer called Robert Farrow who was writing about the family. In other words, a gay man who was trying to force his family to accept his lover, just as they accepted their daughters-in-law or sons-in-law. And it was a very fiery Italian-American family with very high emotions. So that was exciting and interesting, and that was one kind of book. So I guess in a way, we never discussed it, but I think we thought, well, we don't want to go there. That's what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And maybe I was left with childhood and Andrew Holleran, who wrote Dancer from the Dance, was left with Fire Island and the kind of glamorous New York life. So, I don't know, we sort of divided up the world.
You don't write about your life in the 70s until actually just last year, correct?
Yeah.
But can you describe to me that that period of your life, New York after Stonewall, living here as a gay man?
Well, it was a very poor city, and it was bankrupt, almost. And there were very few services, and the garbage people were always on strike, and the police were on strike, and everything was falling apart. And there was a what they call white flight. I mean, the white people were leaving Manhattan and going away. And there was very high crime rate, lots of drug addiction. Anyway, so those were all the negative things, which meant that the rents were cheap, that you didn't have to work too hard to earn enough money to live here. And you could live on Manhattan. This neighborhood, for instance, which is now very pretty, I live in Chelsea, and it's now very gentrified. I remember walking, it was dangerous to walk through here, and there would be black and Puerto Rican men sitting on their stoops, and they would throw bottles at you, and they had ghetto blasters and play loud music, and the buildings were very ugly. There were no trees on the street. Everything was very different. Obviously, the buildings were quite nice, and they'd been built as middle-class houses in the 19th century, but everything had become very run down. But that was also what was exciting about New York, is that it was a very edgy city. Suddenly, there were lots of gay bars, whereas there had been none in the 60s. Now there were 100. And there were back rooms, too, which there had never been before. And there were the piers, which were these abandoned docks that stuck out into the Hudson, where people would go and have sex in these big, huge, abandoned buildings. There were also trucks, and people would get up inside the parked trucks under the West Side Highway and have sex. So there was a lot of outdoor, anonymous sex. And this was an interesting era because it was after the invention of antibiotics, of course, but before the advent of AIDS. So it was a small window of humanity's history, where people were free to do what they wanted to sexually. There were basically no fears about the consequences of sexual acts, even for straight people, because there was birth control, there was abortion, legal abortion. There was, and for gays, there were antibiotics if they got some disease, syphilis, and there was no AIDS. So there were no tragic consequences to sex acts.
One of the things about the book that stuck with me is a moment in which you describe the different types of relations that you had that played very different roles in your life. In other words, you had a lover, somebody that you had sex with, you had a friend, somebody that you hung out with, you had somebody else that played a different role. And this, there was a split of kinship in different persons. So the idea of this monogamous relationship was not really that important. Can you expand on that?
Yes, I mean, we look down on monogamy, and I think the gay leaders of the 70s would be appalled to see how many gays now want to be married and monogamous. But back then, I think pre-AIDS, the idea was that you should be free and you should throw over the heterosexual model and try to invent something new. And part of that was to separate out the various functions that had all been accumulated in a relationship with one person in heterosexual companionate marriage, which we felt didn't work. It was always ending in divorce. It was a disaster. So we thought you should have tricks, who are just one-night stand for sex, fuck buddies, who were people you would see on a regular basis for sex, then you would have a lover who might be somebody you would live with, and you'd have a physical relationship with, in the sense that you'd sleep in the same bed and you would kiss and everything, but maybe you wouldn't have sex, or just occasionally. And I think a lot of gay life is still being lived this way, but I think gays have become so prudish that they don't like to admit it anymore. But we thought it was a positive experiment. I think AIDS changed all that.
Can you speak about AIDS and its consequences to your work?
The Farewell Symphony, even the title, is based on a Haydn symphony where all the instrumentalists get up and leave the stage one after another until only one is playing at the end.
And was that a metaphor for AIDS? For AIDS?
The way I experienced it, in other words, I felt that everybody I had known was dying. Right across the street from where I live is a building with a historical plaque on front of it, and it's where we had our first meetings of the Gay Men's Health Crisis in 1981, and my name's on there because I was the first president of the Gay Men's Health Crisis, which is still the largest and oldest organization for AIDS in the world. Well, I think at first I didn't really respond to the AIDS crisis. I worked throughout the 80s. From like 86 on, I was working on my biography of Jean Genet. And real AIDS activists like Larry Kramer were always angry at me because he would say, "Well, why are you working on that stupid thing when we need you to write about AIDS and blah, blah, blah?" But I felt like gay culture was in danger of being reduced to just one thing, the sickness. And I felt that it was interesting to write about a gay culture hero like Jean Genet in the face of the epidemic, which had become so reductive. There was AIDS, and then there was AIDS, and then there was AIDS. That's all. When people thought of gay people, they thought of AIDS. So we who had been medicalized before, and then we'd escaped that medical definition of homosexuality, were now in danger of being re-medicalized. And it was important, I think, to resist that. I think the first thing I wrote about AIDS must have been about 1988, a little book of stories that I did with Adam Mars Jones, and it was called The Darker Proof. And it was published in paperback in England, and it was some stories by him, some stories by me. And even at that date, 88, we felt there was virtually no gay fiction about AIDS that was being published, and that when you would watch television and people talk about AIDS, it would be a doctor who was not gay discussing this terrible condition. So we thought it was important that gay writers try to show AIDS from within. Like, what was it like to live with it?
You did not employ the act of writing as a form of political activism in that sense, directly along the lines in which other people were.
No, not at all. I mean, one of the reasons I moved to Paris was to escape all this, because I had been the first president of the Gay Men's Health Crisis, and I hated it. I didn't like myself in that role. And I didn't like the idea of devoting all my energy to AIDS activism. So I thought, what I'm good at is writing. And writing always has some political import in the sense that you're reflecting people's experience and forcément, you're showing how a gay man experiences AIDS. I mean, I've ended up writing quite a bit of literature that has to do with AIDS. I mean, The Married Man is an AIDS novel, and The Farewell Symphony is all about people dying of AIDS.
What about the work on René and also later on the biography of Proust? because it seems to be really different ways of looking at these people, at these two men. How are you approaching this this work?
Well, I mean, I was I think I've written about Rambo, Proust, and Genet, three men I would call homosexual. I mean, Rambo maybe the least so, because he seemed to give it up after a certain age, the way he gave up poetry. Although we don't know. We don't know whether, when he lived in Africa, was he gay, was he straight. But in any event, the most significant period of his life, the only reason we know Rambo's name is because he was a great poet between the age of 16 and 19.
And his relationship to Verlaine.
With Verlaine. And that's what the legend really is about. And Verlaine was clearly bisexual. I mean, Verlaine always had women and always had men in his life. So I was very criticized for my little Proust biography by Roger Shattuck and other important Proust scholars in America for making it so gay, as though he wasn't really gay, Proust. And I think it's partly because people who've invested, heterosexual critics who've invested their whole lives in writing about Proust, they don't want him to seem less universal. And if you call him gay, it seems to threaten his status as a great universal writer. That's what they think.
As if the impact of his sexual orientation or identity did not mark also the way that he was writing.
Exactly. I mean, in fact, Proust wrote a very interesting letter to the editor, Gallimard, saying, you should publish my book because it's very interesting. It's the first important book about homosexuality. And he says it in so many words. And yet people conveniently forget that letter. And at other points he calls it an autobiography, although it's clearly a novel.
Have you oftentimes throughout your writing career faced rejection or discrimination from the literary establishment because of similar reasons?
Constantly. But I must point out that the most violent critics of my work for being so homosexual have been other homosexuals.
Why do you think that's the case?
I don't know. I mean, I think maybe I've had 7 long, hateful reviews in my life from people who obviously wanted to destroy me, and they were all gay men.
What I wanted to ask is if the literary establishment has presented itself or is a homophobic institution of sorts.
I think it was in New York more so in the 60s than it is now. I mean, it was very Jewish in the 60s. And I think that the Jews of the generation of Norman Mailer, of Saul Bellow, they were, I think politically they were fairly liberal, and they probably would have worked for the rights of gays and to end persecution of gays. But I think personally they were freaked out by male homosexuality. I don't think they liked it.
I'm struck by this idea of the universality of literature, because it seems to me that sometimes it presents itself as a kind of monolithic institution that lives outside of those social conditions around it. I wonder, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think when you hear, I mean, I think universalism was an idea the French invented in the 18th century.
Right.
And it was a very progressive idea at the time, because it was basically saying, a black woman from the Antilles and a white man from Paris are the same. They're both individuals, and they're citizens, if they are. So the kind of universalism of that period was very progressive. But I think now when people use the word universal it's almost always reactionary. Mm-hmm. Because what they're really trying to say is that if you're not writing about a white heterosexual man, then you're not writing about something universal. Your work is too particular. You're only writing about this Chinese lesbian, and who could possibly care about that? Mm. You know, and I think it was male critics, I mean straight male critics, who dominated then and now the reception of literature, whether it's in the universities or in the critical establishment. Mm. So I think that they obviously have their tastes and their prejudices, and they like to defend them by calling them universal.
When you look retrospectively at your life and your body of work, how do you feel about it?
I feel good about it. I mean, I feel that I've written some good books, and that I've tried hard to. I've never, except for The Joy of Gay Sex, I've never done anything that was commercial. In other words, I've never written anything that was designed to capture a market. I tried to hold myself to the highest artistic standards.
Je ne regrette rien.
I as a result, I'm very poor and not that very well known. But I think that, you know, I might have had a bigger career if I had been more easygoing and more of a compromiser. But I feel good about, I think the fact that my father was rich, although I never inherited any money because he gave it to his second wife, but the fact that he was rich gave me a kind of class confidence that I think it was important for me in being able to be a pure artist. I mean, if you look at writers like Christopher Isherwood, he also had I just wrote an essay about him, so I'm thinking about him. But when you ask yourself, how did he come to write A Single Man in the 60s, which is really the first gay, openly gay text about contemporary life that has no ideology of how did this man come to be gay, mm-hmm. that has no apology, that shows him moving around in the normal world and even being open about his homosexuality with other friends mm-hmm. who are heterosexual. How did he come to write this book? And I think you have to say two or three things. That, for instance, that he participated in the first gay liberation movement of Berlin in the 1920s. But I think the most important thing is that he had a kind of class confidence. He was of the English gentry, and I think they've always had a sort of, oh, I can say anything I want to mm. attitude.
What are your thoughts on aging as a gay man?
Well, I've been very lucky because I assume that in the 50s, we used to have a funeral for gay men when they turned 30. And I always thought, oh, yeah, maybe you could stretch it out to 40, you know. But then when I got to be 40, maybe you could stretch it out to be 50. Now I'm 71. And I don't know, it seems like I have as much sex as I ever did. But most of that is thanks to the internet, where you can find these highly specialized markets, you know. Mm-hmm. In other words, you can find attractive people who like older men, even chubby older men. I mean, it's all very organized, and before the internet, you never could have found these people.